Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the museum. I'm John Holler, the CEO, and it's my pleasure to welcome you tonight to our closing event of Revolutionaries 2012. On behalf of the board, our staff, our members, and our amazing volunteers, we're really, really pleased to have you here tonight. Major funding for the Revolutionary series is made possible by Intel. We're very grateful to Intel for its financial support for the fourth year in a row, the major funder of our lecture series, and additional funding is provided this year by the William K. Bowes Jr. Foundation. The story of how Eric Schmidt came to be chairman and CEO of Google in 2001 is the stuff of book-length articles and book-length books. I Googled Eric using his own product today, and I got exactly 43,900,000 search results back. The one on top, of course, was the one I was looking for, because that's Google's goal, as we know, and it was surrounded tastefully by relevant advertising. So my little search contributed to the roughly $11 billion that Google will earn in this quarter. It would be hard to imagine more than 10 years ago someone better suited to the job of helping Google grow up than Eric Schmidt, a PhD in computer science, a software engineer and scholar, a background in startups, chief technology officer at Sun Microsystems, CEO of the big networking company Novell, and most importantly, as co-founder Sergey Brin later said, he was the only candidate they interviewed who had been to Burning Man. Tonight we will explore with Eric what he's seen and done in the Google Revolution, a decade of history-making and invention at one of the most remarkable companies of our time, and we'll talk about his vision for what's ahead. Please join me in welcoming Eric Schmidt. We're so glad to have you here.
Oh, thank you. And before we begin, let me just say I really appreciate you all supporting the Computer History Museum. You know, Gordon Bell founded this 15, 20 years ago, and when it ultimately was relocated here, we were able to really get the most amazing collection of the history that most of us have lived through. And so for me to go through the exhibits and go, oh my God, I didn't realize how ugly it was or how slow it was or whatever. The only quibble I have is that at the opening you said you have to turn off your phones. Turn on your phones. We love our phones.
Anyway. So we won't bother with the ringtones or anything else that happens, right? So long as people are tweeting and posting and...
It's a mobile world, guys. Get used to it.
Of course, absolutely. Let me start off you know, in this little film that we showed beforehand, you're talking about the Burroughs architecture. Did you ever figure out what it was about, maybe not that, but a piece of technology like you were just talking about that was really deeply meaningful to you in shaping what you pursued?
I think this faculty member, who was Bob Fabry at Berkeley, who's since retired, was actually trying to teach me an arrogance lesson. I don't think it was about facts at all, because I was really sure that this thing sucked. And I had a much better design. And he was trying to teach me a lesson that I would pass on to you, that there was some really smart person who really thought this was really good, and maybe I should understand why before I just willingly attack them without any basis. My architecture, by the way, was better, but theirs was good too. And I learned an important lesson about humility. Our industry tends to attract very smart, very arrogant people who want to change the world, which is great. Right, but let's have a little respect for the people who preceded them, who were trying to make the world a good place too.
Let me start off by asking you, if you remember the first time you encountered the World Wide Web and what you thought about it and what it meant to you at that moment.
I remember it quite well because I was at Sun, and this was in January roughly 1992, and we had finished a series of announcements at Sun in the networking space, and I remember meeting with my team and saying, pretty much everything that is going to be invented in networking has been invented, sort of the typical error. And I was quite convinced of it because I could see nothing new or interesting aside from improvements in bandwidth and improvements in router technology, which Sun, by the way, had managed to invent some and then give up because we weren't focused on it. So I was quite annoyed about that. And I remember sitting there thinking, you know, it's sort of calm and boring. And then John Gage had discovered Mosaic, which I think everybody understands is the predecessor of all of this, and came in and gave a presentation of this, what was essentially a link structure and a directory. And we said, oh my God. And of course, it's to Tim Berners-Lee's credit that he invented this, you know, while he was at CERN. And what's interesting is that I remember sitting there at the time saying, why didn't we invent this? Right? I mean, that's our job, right? We're supposed to be the innovators. Why is this random guy who I don't know, who turns out to be brilliant, but that's a separate discussion, you know, sitting in outside of Geneva do this? Because we had all the precursors. We had all the necessary. We were busy, if the technical people will remember that you were basically moving FTP files around and opening them up. And we had, you know, the Usenet link structure and so forth. But it was a leap of genius from Tim that did it. And another lesson that you learn from that is that often innovation occurs from outside the industry, even your own, right? Which is always a shocking fact, especially for us.
So let's skip ahead just a bit from there to 2001. Search engines had been around for a while, and Google certainly was not the first one to the party when it came to search.
In fact, Google would say we were the last. Right. Right. We were.
You were.
We were. There were many fine choices beforehand.
So in that context, what was it about Google as a proposition that really seemed attractive to you?
Well, I actually didn't think Google would account to much, so show you how smart I was. As I understand what was happening was that the predecessors, AltaVista and the other search engines that were present at the time, were relatively easily biased by clicks. And so this was early in the development of the web, and it was sort of accepted that if you wanted a higher ranking or better treatment, you would just click more. Now, if we look at it in hindsight, that's obviously a wrong strategy. So Larry and Sergey, and in particular Larry, developed the PageRank algorithm, which is independent of click rates. In other words, the rankings are not determined by the number of times that you click on something. And that that strategy gave a differentiated solution. And I suspect that they were also helped by the fact that they started out at Stanford. They had a lot of very, very smart friends who were sort of among the cognoscenti. The fact that the accuracy was better spread, and it became a word-of-mouth phenomenon.
Then, at that same time as you were starting to look at that technical side of it, in your specific discussions with Sergey and Larry at the time, as they were thinking about bringing someone in, everything that's been written makes it very clear that the chemistry has been important from the very beginning. Did you have a sense of that as you were going through that whole process?
They were unusual, but I was unusual too. There's a way I would understand it. So they had been searching for a CEO for 16 months before. And the board had agreed to do the search, and they'd hired a very, very successful recruiter to run this. And they would haul these people in, and they would barrage them with questions. And their strategy for interviewing people was to spend a lot of time with them. So you had to go skiing with them, right, which I refused, although I liked to ski. It just didn't seem relevant at the time. But they were very concerned about fit as well. And it turns out that although we were divergent in age, we had a very common underlying basis of history. Jeff Ullman was my faculty member at Princeton. He was also Larry and Sergey's faculty member here at Stanford. We had pretty much the same personal, social, executive, and technological views. And so when you meet people like that, you don't really have a choice but to work with them. And sort of my advice would be, when you meet somebody who's that alter ego, don't let them go, right? Find a way, however crazy and however weird, to make them part of your world and you. Because the benefit of having a partner in a business context is completely undervalued. We have this sort of myth that the executive, the sort of, you know, smart executive who makes all these unilateral decisions and is so incredibly smart. But if you look, every company, even the iconic companies, are led by teams. And the best way to do that is with highly bound partnerships. And what I learned in working with Larry and Sergey was that we would fight very, very hard over issues, but there was not a moment where there was any question as to their motivation or mine in terms of making the company successful. We had complete goal alignment. And that is such a great thing in life.
And it's been that way from the beginning.
Yes, it was always.
Yeah.
And in my case, I didn't even interview anywhere else. I just knew. And again, I would encourage you, if you find yourself in this situation, jump. Because it's so personally successful. you integrate your families and your life and your social, you know, all the things that you care about. And something really fascinating is going to happen. I was personally skeptical of the success of the company. I thought this ad thing, right, like, is this going to work or what? In fact, when I first started as CEO, I actually insisted that the finance people come and show me the capital accounts and the cash accounts, because I was concerned that there was fraud going on, because people couldn't really be clicking these things. But indeed they were, and I learned very clearly and very, very well that these ads were extraordinarily valuable. So again, I was wrong, and the rest took off.
I want to talk about that ad thing here in a minute, but just a couple more questions about the early history and your thinking about it. You have a PhD in computer science.
That's correct.
Was that important to you as you were first moving into the company? You know, there's this sort of phrase about someone having the chops to do the job, and I just wonder if having that PhD and having done what you did was important in the early days as you onboarded
it. With respect to Google, I'm not sure it was the degree was important. It was certainly important to be technical to understand the challenges. One of the great things about computer scientists is that we're trained around scale and replication. And so Google at the time, and today is still true, is really about sort of a community of people moving in synchrony with an awful lot of freedom to innovate. And it takes a certain kind of training to understand that that's how you win and that you have to tolerate failure and so forth. And the way you build growth quickly is through scale and sort of allowing this sort of growth to occur naturally and very, very quickly.
And then there's this Googliness that people have within Google. That word has come to define the culture. How early did you understand being Googly was really a value?
Well, Larry and Sergey talked about it a great deal, and I assumed that it was a marketing ploy on their part, which was fine. You know, marketing is fine. So after a few months, I was sitting in one of the conference rooms, and I would come up to speed, and I understood issues. And there was a discussion over a particular interaction between search results and ads. And these are complex issues involving, you know, what kind of data can you use and so forth. And one of the engineers pounds his fist on the table and says, "That's evil." And it was as though a bomb had gone off. Because I had never seen this kind of behavior. I was used to, I'm going to use the term digital equipment corporation, sort of horizontal, sort of, they're hierarchical, but they're still team-oriented, which is sort of roughly the way Sun was run. So the fact that this thing was bottoms up and that somebody could literally felt empowered to do that, I think showed it. At exactly the same time, I walked into my office. I had a little tiny little 8x12 office, and I discover I have a roommate. And is nice gentleman who identifies himself as a meat. And I said, "Well, hello." And he goes, "Hi, you know, I'm your new roommate." And I said, "Okay." You never, you know, at Google, you never fire, you always listen first. You know, you're never quite sure what they're up to. And so I said, "Amita, you know, how are you here?" And he said, "Well, you know, my office had 6 people and you're never here." And I said, "Okay." And I said, "Did you check with anybody as to whether," and by the way, we're talking about his table's here and my table's here. And I look at my assistant who's out in the hallway, and she gives me this, "I don't know what's going on" look, right? So like, it's one of those things where it's, you're in a new culture and you don't quite know how to behave, and said, "Okay, so who, did anyone suggest that you might do this?" Said, "Yeah, I checked with Ryan Rosing, who's the VP of engineering, who works for me." And he goes, "Wayne suggested it." And so I go, "Ah, this is Wayne's practical joke on me." So the problem is, at this point, you can't kick the guy out. So I said, "Okay." So we sit next to each other, and I mean next to each other, like this. And he's an engineer, and he puts his headphones on, and he programs. And I'm busy doing whatever I'm doing at the time. This goes on for a few weeks. And, you know, every day, just like when we work, you know, we work hard 12 hours a day. We don't really talk to each other because he's busy and I'm busy. And one day, I'm on the phone to Omid, who's running sales. And Omid goes, we're having this argument over revenue, and I still remember the number was, Omid said the revenue is going to be $121 million. And I said, "Well, how do you know that?" You know, we're having this conversation. So we hang up the phone, and Amit, who's my next door neighbor, literally right here, takes his headphone off and says, "I know what the revenue is." And I go, what? You've been listening in? He said, I listened into all your conversations. I go, okay, thank you for, you know, he's an engineer, so he tells the truth, right? So I said, okay, Amit, thank you for letting me know. And so I said, well, what is the revenue number? He says, it's going to be $142 million. And I said, how do you know? I'm in charge of building the systems that produce the revenue projections. And I said, you are? So if you're going to have a roommate, this is by far the best roommate to ever have your CEO. Keeps his headphones on, tell you the revenue number, because revenue is everything. So I said, okay. And again, in Google, you know, you sort of don't act. So I said, okay, how can I use this information? So Omid calls up, and I said, Omid, how are you doing on the quarter? And he says, revenue's getting better. What's it at? 132. I said, good, good, good. Is there any evidence of sandbagging in your organization? And he goes, no. I said, good, I'm glad to hear it. I would never want you to sandbag and give me a number lower than the number you're going to hit. And he said, our systems are producing 132. And of course, he was using a different and less accurate system than my engineer. So this goes on, and eventually, of course, it's exactly 142. So we bought a large sandbag, and we made Omid make all of his presentations standing on the sandbag. And Amit and I became best friends, and we were office mates for actually years. We could not continue this after we became public because of materiality. And he's a great human being. That's Googliness for you.
That's a great Googly story. You know, Stephen Levy found Amit. Stephen Levy found Amit when he was writing in the Plex. We had Stephen here last year to talk about it, and he asked Amit, what's the number one thing you learned from Eric? And he said, I learned I would never want to be the CEO.
Really? Is that what he said?
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about how Google does what it does. And I'm going to ask you a question that we talked about just a few minutes ago, and I'm really curious about the answer, which is, think about 2001 and the technology that existed when you started Google then, and think about the technology you're using today. If what existed today had existed back then, would you have done Google the same way? How would you have done things differently?
I think the biggest change would be that all of our first attempts at programs would be on a mobile device and not on a web device. So if I go back to 10 years ago, what was the story? It was HTML 2 or 3 and the various DSS and other sort of CSS standards and so forth at the time. And we optimized around that platform. This was before the technology that ultimately would allow things like Gmail. So this was before JavaScript would allow you to build these sort of powerful web apps. So today what we would do is we would have gone straight at building these powerful mobile apps using these sort of new technologies. And of course we'd have a lot more bandwidth. But I think the other aspects of our approach, which are the core algorithm that we use, we would use exactly the same. And we would certainly do the same advertising model because we were fortunate that by moving to this ROI-based database system, we really did produce a huge revenue growth. I have another story for you. We, one weekend, we decided to make a database transition, which was called Project Drano. And it's a pretty big deal in a small company. We didn't have a lot of cash. So what happens is I come in on the Saturday and the Sunday to see what's happening, and I walk over to the engineers, and I say, what are you working on? They said, working on this project, and that's great. Why are you not at the data centers? And they go, we've never been at the data centers. And I said, you're just about to do the most important transition in the company, and you are not there to watch and make sure these servers stay up? Said, no, never occurred to us. So today, you would build Google on top of one of these extraordinarily set of cloud computing services, and it would happen much faster as a result. Google has had to build all of the infrastructure to handle these complex web services, deal with denial of service attacks, deal with replication, complex things involving the SQL databases, and those all those things are now well established. We would just occur faster.
Is this the equivalent of a pivot for you? Are you constantly having to change a huge amount of the underlying architecture? I mean, it seems like it's like trying to change the tires on an Indy car as it's going around the track.
I think it's fair to say that Google's infrastructure goes through these cycles which are 2 to 3 years old. And they go something like, the key scientists invent a new way of doing what we call sharded file storage. where you can spread the files in an even more sophisticated way. Google is all about sparse matrices, large numbers of entry matrices of information, which are we do math over to do ranking and things like that. We're constantly coming up with sort of new ways of doing that. We invented a particular way of organizing all the computers to give us the answers back. Again, that's now popularized in the public eye in something called Hadoop, which is open source technology, which does something similar. We again have version 2, version 3, version 4 of all of those systems. So I'd say it's fair to say that we have one of these every 2 to 3 years, and I suspect that will be always true. Every system, another example, for years, the Gmail infrastructure was on a database system that stored all of your attachments and so forth. It was incompatible with the database system that stored all of your search results. And there were complex technical reasons why. And I remember one day Larry decided that he was fed up with this, so he got all the technical teams together and asked each of them to present the reasons why their database approaches were correct. And of course, there were 12 approaches, and everyone had exactly the reason they were right and why everyone else was wrong. And I remember him coming back to me and saying, I don't know what to do, you know, how do I get this sorted out? And of course, Larry, by sheer force, you know, went in and sort of got these teams to sort of put together this sort of scalable architecture, and we're now on a common one. So this phenomena where you have divergent systems, which you then have to unify by one level of abstraction, I think is characteristic of computer science. I would tell you that this opportunity continues to be true in cloud computing in general. Today, there are large numbers of startups here in the Valley and elsewhere that are essentially rebuilding UI tools of one kind or another, various forms of storing data, et cetera, and somebody's going to come along with new infrastructure that will standardize that, and then they'll become even more productive. So the consequence is that today, if you're starting a startup, it takes a few programmers, you can rent or buy all the infrastructure, you never meet your servers, like I was trained to when I was a younger executive. And in fact, if you founded a company today, you would not have an IT department. You would use a combination of the cloud computing solutions and the Google App solutions. It's all you'd ever need.
You said something a minute ago that I just want to follow up on, which is that Sergey will go in and start to make some of these things happen. There are so many stories about his active involvement in so many different aspects of the company from a technology standpoint. Is that rare in your experience? Is that unusual? Do you find this to be just an exceptional aspect of the way Google works?
I would say it is normal in the most successful companies. If you look at the history of Apple, Intel, Oracle, Microsoft, there was a key technical leader or a couple that would go in and drive change. One of the things that happens with engineering teams is they get sort of used to their own sort of structure and thinking, and sometimes you have to push and push hard to get people to sort of merge their views or combine their approaches or so forth. And that's one of the arts of engineering management in all tech companies. In my time as CEO, it actually worked. It was actually remarkably easy because Larry and Sergey would run ahead. Literally, by the time I had arrived at something, they had already been through and rationalized these. And that's why our partnership has worked well, so well for so long.
Hmm. Let's talk about that ad thing that you were talking about a few minutes ago. Can you describe the aha moment?
Yeah, it's
when you learned advertising was going to be as incredibly successful as it has been.
I mentioned this transition in Project Drano.
Project Drano?
Who knows?
Why was it called Drano?
God knows. You know, some 23-year-old named it. you know, it's fine, whatever. And so I remember I mentioned that we did this transition over the weekend. We did it successfully, and it was a key decision in the first year was we had three separate advertising systems, and we combined to one. And we, of course, moved to the one that was the riskiest. And the system was designed by a product manager, his name is Salar, who now runs YouTube, by the way, and who was one of the true heroes of Google by virtue of having invented all of this. And at the time, he was, you know, 23 or 24 years old. And I remember first walking up to him and said, you better not screw up because you're going to bankrupt this company. And he looks at me, all of 24, and says, not to worry, we'll be fine. And I go, okay. And of course, he was exactly right. We made this transition to this new model, which had to do with the way the auction worked, and our revenue began to grow very, very, very quickly. But for the first few weeks, we had forgotten to do some of the systems that you need to deal with customers, in particular revenue reporting, click reporting, and so forth. for some reason or another, I had flown to New York, which is where advertising was run, to meet with Tim Armstrong, who, an exceptional sales executive now running AOL. And I was meeting with Tim, and then I had a little cube where I was doing my work, and I'm overhearing, it's 5 o'clock, and I'm overhearing a young woman who's in our ad sales department who's in the cube next to me, and sort of loud in a New York sort of way. And, okay, I'm listening to this. I'm sorry, we don't have your report. I'm sorry, I know. You know, and it sounds like there's some death or something. So this goes on for maybe 20 minutes, and so I go over to this young lady, and I said, I need to know what's going on, you know, and she said, he calls me every day at 5. I said, why? He said, if the company that he's in depends on the clicks that day, if I don't have the report to him at 5, he may lose his job by 6 or 7. And I said, what? He said, you don't understand. You've always worked in these companies with all this cash. Most businesses are hand-to-mouth. We gave them the cash to make their payroll, and we're not telling them how much. He doesn't know whether he should lay off people. And then she goes into this, you know, sort of, you know, sending his sort of guilt trip to me. And I go, I got it, right? So I got on the plane, flew back, and we got the reports out. But it was a lesson that things which we think are toys, they're interesting and fun, and we use these are essential. So from that moment on, I understood that Google was not some interesting technological experiment, but it was rather something that was deeply embedded in how people got paid. The accuracy was important. I remember Sergey getting a letter, which he showed me very proudly, from a fellow who said that, thank you for saving his life, because he typed, I'm having a heart attack, and the first result was, you're having a heart attack, call 911, these are your symptoms. And the ambulance said that if he hadn't called them immediately, he would have been dead in, you know, five minutes later. So you understand all of a sudden the power of information is not just some interesting academic thing, but it's fundamental to people's lives, their privacy, the way they operate, the way they get paid, how they grow, and all those things.
And then as far as Google's own business model goes, those of us who are old enough to remember Lycos and AltaVista and all of those other search engines, we were quite used to seeing paid search results pop up, which were absolutely irrelevant to what you were searching for. But fairly early on, Google unlocked the fact that you could combine advertising and search and a business model for Google that was unlike anything that had ever been done. When did that become clear?
Again, a story from the first year. You know, I sort of get it as a new CEO, and I kind of understand. I'm trying to run everything. And Larry likes to look at how the product works. And so he gets increasingly upset with our ads. So because they weren't very good, in his opinion. So he takes a series of queries, which he thinks are representative. He types them in. He prints them out on a piece of paper in the whiteboard in the break room. And he writes a note saying, these ads are terrible. Can you guys critique them? So for the afternoon, right, everybody is busy critiquing them. Well, that's a stupid ad, or this should have been a different, or the ordering was wrong. Then he writes another note, and the other note says, can't one of you guys fix this? And I thought, now this is going to be really interesting. This is the founder just wrote a random note in the break room. You know, normally you would like call the vice president of engineering, you know, and the directors of engineering and all that. Didn't do that. So I figured, okay, we'll see what happens. This is a Friday at 5. I was doing something else over the weekend, and I came in Monday morning. The problem had been solved. A set of engineers who were not in the ads group at the time had thought it was a really interesting question, and they invented the algorithm over the weekend. That's amazing. So then, Larry and Sergey decided that they didn't like the engineering management that had not done this. So we decided to do a disorg, which was to become disorganized. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a disaster. So
this is a formal thing. This is a term of art, a disorg.
Well, it was, you have to name things in order to, you know, to implement them. So I said, okay. So we ended up reorganizing things so that one of our executives had 121 reports. He is an extraordinary executive who now works as a venture capitalist. And I would say to him, how do you do on your one-on-ones? He said, oh, I try to not have them. And so the hardest thing to have 121 direct reports is writing the reviews. But he managed to pull it off. Eventually, we got the right management and the right kind of culture set.
I'm going to ask one final question about the past, and then we'll move on to today and especially tomorrow. Larry, I think, was famous for saying, Larry Page, that Google's ideal in search would be if the engine knew exactly what you were trying to say when you typed in your search result, and it gave you back exactly the thing that you were looking for, and it did it every single time.
That was Larry's proposal. Sergey's proposal was that there would be some sort of thing we screwed into your brain. And I said, Sergey, would you stop? And of course, he was joking, just for the record.
So how close are you? We're not going to be screwing things into our brain anytime soon, but how close are you to Larry's original vision?
We're getting there. It's a race, because what you forget is that the information explosion is all around us. Something like 97 or 98% of the content that's now on the internet is user-generated. So if the user would stop generating all this new content, which of course is not going to happen, I think we could get closer to it. But the fact of the matter is it's a race between increasingly sophisticated algorithms that are hard to describe but are magical against this extraordinary increase in data. We think our algorithms are by far the best. I think most people agree. But we're always being critical. Last year, we had about 500 improvements to our search algorithm. You don't see them because they're incremental. But when you understand the challenge that the other end says, the amount of incoming, you'll appreciate how difficult the ranking problem is. You have to take, as you pointed out, 50 million things or 100 million things and rank them so that there's a 1, a 2, a 3, and a 4. And you have to do that in milliseconds.
Okay, data. Let's talk about data for a minute. Sure. It's only just now, I think, becoming clear, at least in the popular media, the role that data played in the presidential campaign.
Sure.
And you were embedded for many months with the Obama campaign, and the stories that are coming out now are just fascinating about the way data worked this time around. Can you talk a little bit about that, what you saw and what the influence was?
Yeah, when I was not doing my Google stuff, I was working with Jim Messina, who's a personal friend, in Chicago on the campaign, on the infrastructure, not on the policy issues. And the infrastructure can be summarized as a cloud computing platform with mobile apps to mobilize people, with backups that you'd print out, with heavy use of Google Docs, Google Spreadsheets, and Google Maps, which I was very proud of. The wonderment of a political campaign, and I think this is true of both the Republicans and the Democrats, is that these are, in this case, each side spent on the order of $1.2 billion over 18 months. They hired in the Democratic campaign, I think, on the order of 5,000 professional people, and they had on the order of 1.5 million volunteers, all of which culminates in activity on a single day. The technology that was used in data was roughly the following. There are these things called voter files, which are produced by the secretaries of state. And I did not know this, but that information is public and updated quite frequently. So your voter history, and not who you voted for, but that you voted, along with your address, typically your home address, as well as a few other identifying things, is in fact available. And so both campaigns used that data to build essentially a profile around people. Start with the voter file. And most of it, people have gotten this message wrong, most of the information was information that you volunteered. But what happened is you would log in, identify yourself, and then the computers would match that to the voter file, and then they would do a score. And the most interesting thing is that if the score is zero, then you're probably going to vote for the other side, so we're not going to spend too much time on you. If your vote is 100, score is 100, then you're probably going to be a volunteer, and we're not going to spend that much time on you. So the targeting was around people who were likely to support our side, but who needed some inducements. And to give you an idea of how ridiculous this can get, people would have their doors knocked on 6 times. Like, after a few times, wouldn't you like decide to vote or not? Right? And I was told that people like to have a conversation. And of course, because of the extraordinary amount of money in the campaign, people were subjected to 50 or 60 political ads every week that they actually saw, for which both campaigns spent literally fortunes, enriched the TV industry no end. So the data analytics was an integral part in both the targeting or understanding who the voters were and then what is called get out the vote. And get out the vote is ultimately a volunteer who has what is a walk list, and they walk around a little neighborhood and they knock on doors and say, can I help you? Do you need any help getting to the polls and so forth? And I think most of the analysis indicated that this technology gave the Obama campaign a couple points of advantage, which was enough to take swing states. And I don't know why, by the way, as a country, we have decided to only have 5 states elect our president, but that's a separate discussion. And thank you all for voting here in California, but I'm not sure it mattered. By the way, I was joking. Please vote anyway. And say the same thing in the Republican states. But the fact of the matter is that this enormous focus did ultimately produce strong wins for the president in the campaign, and I think that technology was certainly part of it.
I think I read a story where on the Sunday before the election, someone in the campaign was getting some intelligence, and the Obama campaign was getting some intelligence from the Romney campaign about the campaign had knocked on 55,000 doors that Sunday to get out the vote in Ohio, and it was alarming. And the president happened to walk in at that moment, and this 55,000 door-knocking story was going around, and someone turned to one of the people working in data and said, tell him the door thing. And he said, well, I wouldn't worry about that too much because we knocked on 343,000 today. Is that the kind of, disparity there was at the end of the campaign?
Another thing that the Obama campaign did particularly well is register new people. One of the things that you saw on television, and it was interesting, by the way, to see the actual data versus what the television people said. And they didn't have as good engineers, you know. They didn't have the real science behind it. But if you look at the Obama campaign managed to get better turnout among young people than they did in 2008, which was one of the sort of memes that everybody assumed would be false, and that was not in fact it was greater turnout and huge registration gains. And, you know, I would argue registering to vote is a good thing, regardless of party.
Now, along these same lines, you're just about to publish a book, aren't you, on technology and diplomacy. Is that the subject?
It's hard to describe what it's about. It's about what the world is going to be like when 5 billion people join us to our party. Book should come out early next year. My co-author is a guy named Jared Cohen, who now works at Google. He's a brilliant young man who worked in the State Department. It's not primarily a technical book. It's more about what happens when everybody has mobile phones. And we spent a lot of time discussing how governments will react to it, and our core thesis is governments have no idea what we're doing, right? The impact of empowering citizens is going to revolutionize the way governments interact with their citizens. It's almost all good, by the way. So it's clearly an optimistic message, and there's a number of cautionary areas.
Can we do a book launch here at the museum?
I'm sure.
Let's do. Increasingly, the consumer world seems to be dividing up into a quartet of Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook. Would you agree with that assessment? And if so, roughly, can you all coexist together? Is there enough room for everyone? How are we as consumers going to be affected by this coalescence?
The point of the four is not that there are four, excuse me, it's not that the specific companies, but that there are four as opposed to one. All of us grew up with either an IBM dominance or a Microsoft dominance. I've, of course, grown up with both. And we've never had a situation where we had four extremely well-run, tough, smart, global, scalable, very rich companies that are vying for a declining cost business. So one way to think about it is think about it as the contest between the four. I can give you the numbers about Android, so do a little plug for Android while we're here. Android is lighting up 1.3 million phones per day. Industry estimates are that the scale of Android is on the order of 4 times larger than the iPhone infrastructure. And iPhone is quite good, by the way. We have more than 500 million Android phones installed, and we have more than 700,000 apps, which roughly rivals the number of apps in the Apple App Store. And the competition between the two, and of course Apple has a great story too, produces amazing value for you. Think about what's happening over this brutal competition between these two companies, and the back and the forth and the screaming and the lawsuits and so forth and so on. You're winning. Look at Amazon, and which has clearly done a fantastic job in building the world's largest store, not just bookstore. And then think about all the partnership programs and what Apple's trying to do and what Google's trying to do to compete with that. You benefit from that in terms of fast delivery, no sales tax, no payments, what have you, no shipping charges, et cetera. And now people are getting into same-day delivery. Who funds this? Competition. Look at Facebook, which has now a competitor in Google+, which is doing quite well and sort of coming up at them, forcing them to both open up their strategies as well as focus on their monetization and serve their customers. In each of these cases, they are network platforms that scale enormously. In defense of Apple, and I was, of course, proudly on their board for 3+ years, they have many, many important partners above and below their ecosystem. Well, that's also true of Google. It's also true of Amazon. Amazon is a platform for resellers. So many people now put their products through Amazon to get them to you. And Facebook, of course, through Facebook Connect and the Open Graph, has a similar partnership strategy. We've never had four like that. Now, we can debate whether there's a fifth. People have argued that it should be Netflix or it should be Twitter. It's interesting people don't argue that it's Microsoft. But that's sort of the nature of things, that the architectures move forward. And I think the four are fantastic value. It's a real pain, right, to be in one of them, because the other guys are really good. And so you can't use the classic strategy of we're just smarter, we won't talk to you, because the other guys are just as smart, just as capable, and feel just as strongly about how well they're serving their consumers.
In this era of emerging mobility that you talked about just a minute ago, and all four of you are rushing to that platform, what are you learning about the way we behave? What are the things that you're finding out about us that are influencing your business direction? Not only what your competitors are doing, but what we're doing.
I think it's early to say that. We're busy empowering all of us with devices that can be used for this information. There are complicated privacy and data uses issues which are still not fully worked out. We're trying to be conservative about that. The most important fact that's true now toward the end of 2012 is that for normal people, and I would claim I'm not normal, so I'm excluding myself from this, people who don't spend all day on a keyboard, you find that the combination of the phones and the tablets pretty much replace your need for a PC. To me, that's a shocking thing to say. If you'd asked me that 2 years ago, I'd say, no, that's not going to happen. But we have a lot of evidence that people's primary computer in the non-knowledge worker, sort of the normal people, not people who are tied to desks, certainly not programmers or what have you, they can get pretty much what they need done. And they prefer it because it's more convenient. I'll give you an example. I use Google Maps. I use a Mac. I have Google Maps on my Mac or any PC. Why does my Maps not show me where I am? Oh, it doesn't have a GPS. Why doesn't my Mac have a GPS? Oh, it's not supposed to be used outside. It gets wet. But once you get used to having an accurate GPS signal, you say, why doesn't my map show me where I am? I'm using that as an example to talk about convenience. Now, I'm of the generation of guys that thinks that instead of tinkering on your car, you just build your computer. So for me, the fact that you have to wire your GPS and plug everything in and so forth and build everything by hand is perfectly good. It's what I occupy my free time on. That's not normal. Okay? People actually want their car to just work. Turn it on and it just works. So what's happened with these mobile devices is that the standard for consumer utility that just works is so tough now. And again, to criticize the four, each of the four, and in fact most of the other large companies, are still in a web to mobile transition. I was talking to the CEO of Live Nation, right? Something like 60 or 70% of the tickets that they sell are now purchased on phones. And I said, you've got to be kidding. And I said, no, here's how it works. It was interesting data. Concerts are always sold out immediately. People always have their phone. The alert comes on because there are services which tell you, XYZ group, your favorite group is going to perform. They sell out within 5 minutes. Boom! You just bought the ticket. because you know somebody else is going to compete with you. That point is a generic point, I think, of how our world will evolve, because we're always going to be connected.
I'm glad you raised the subject of maps.
Are you referring to those excellent Apple maps?
Were you surprised at the backlash that occurred when Apple switched the map platform?
It was a rare misstep on Apple's part. Apple's a well-run company. They have very happy customers. They're a tough competitor. It was a rare error on their part. And I think that they misjudged how much better our maps were. They made a decision a couple of years ago, and we know this because they were busy buying companies. I left the board, so I wasn't part of any of this, to offer their own maps to compete. And I don't think that they properly understood the amount of capital investment and time that it takes to build your own maps. Because we had had a project which is internally known as Ground Truth, where we had mapped everything, we actually had, remember all the cars and driving around? Well, we've been driving with cars, mapping roads precisely for maybe 5 years. And so those incredibly accurate maps serve as the basis for why somehow Google Maps works better than anyone else's. And it will take some time for Apple, I think, to catch up. I think that they have every intent of competing with us. They've not indicated somehow surrender on this particular issue. And I think it's, it is what it is. It was a competitive decision that they made.
Do you have any prediction about where this may ultimately come out?
I think people will continue to use Google Maps. They'll find a way to use Google Maps. Google Maps is just too good. And they're so, I'm sorry. But it is actually my opinion. And the other thing about maps is you think of maps as being sort of boring. Trust me, they're not boring because maps are locations, places are where you go. Places are alive. So we took our maps infrastructure and we hung places and ads and maneuvers and businesses and so forth on top of that. So when we talk about maps, we're not talking about some static thing. We're talking about a much more sophisticated sort of ecological or ecosystem, if you will, of information that's central to your daily life. I'll give you another example. I used to think that calendars were really boring. I don't know about you all. And then I met somebody who said that we use Google Calendars to schedule my whole family. And then I met somebody who uses Google Calendars to schedule their whole company. And of course, Google uses Google Calendars to schedule our own company. Why is this relevant? Because the maps are completely integrated and shared. So something which was really static and really uninteresting, when it became integrated, shared, and fully expressible in a programmatic sense, all of a sudden it becomes a new interesting platform. That's the narrative in each of the areas that Google has tried to pursue, and it's worked well. It's one of the reasons why the stickiness, if you will, of our apps, people really like them because they have this sort of amazing capability of sort of coming alive on the line.
Well, for me, the change in maps brought absolutely into my consciousness something I really had stopped thinking about, which is
and by the way,
integral.
I should add, I'm sorry to interrupt. That's you realize that the Google Maps are available on the Android phones? Okay. You are.
Oh,
aware.
Really?
Yeah, they are. And there's some fine choices.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
Anyway, now I know how much I depend on a great map, and I didn't know that before.
Well, we can get you an Android phone. They're available for all the carriers you use.
Okay. Thanks very much, Eric. I appreciate that.
And do you realize... Oh, sorry. I can keep going. Do you realize,
I'm sure you could.
Do you realize that you can actually take your music into the Android Play system and do the match without having to pay the $25 that Apple charges you? Now there.
There you go.
Saved you $25.
I wonder, you're at a point now as a company where even this, you talked about the volume of phones that are being activated on a daily basis, which is just a mind-blowing number of phones activated daily.
And just, I'm sorry to keep interrupting, but do the math in terms of growth rates. These numbers have been doubling every 6 months, and they're not going to grow that fast because you can't grow that way forever. But at roughly 1.3 million per day, right? How many days are there per year? 365. Do the math. We're 500 million. We'll be at a billion plus, sometime next summer if current trends continue. And that number is only going to grow. We will eventually run out of humans, but the good news from our perspective is people like to have more than one phone.
So is this Schmidt's Law? Have we just heard Schmidt's Law coined here?
John, I'm going to let you... You're in charge of the History Museum. You can name things.
I'm...
That's the unique position you have as being in charge. You can define trends and laws.
You may have just made history tonight. I don't think we will call it the law of Project Drano. I'm pretty sure we won't.
I'm sorry.
We won't be doing that. Let me ask you, though. Your business and technical models are now so pervasive that a change that Google makes in the way that it does something ripples out at an incredible rate now across businesses, technology companies, partners, consumers. Is there a point at which the sheer size and pervasiveness of these things becomes a constraint in some way on innovation?
Of course. And I would argue, in fairness, that the other three of the four that we named have similar issues.
I agree.
You know, one of the things is once you get one of these things going, it becomes your own sort of trap. It traps you into your history. You can't make changes too quickly. You're subject to God knows how many regulations, et cetera, et cetera. So these do become constraints. If you build the system properly, your consumers help you. They build your next app on top of your platform, or they show you the path, they build you the infrastructure, they call you, they help you. They need you to be successful, and that's in fact the secret. A very strong outreach to these partners. And I mean technical outreach.
There's been quite a bit of speculation that we're moving into this post-internet era, as it's called, and maybe what you're talking about with mobile and the mobile platform is what's leading that. I want to make a segue into talking about the future now by asking you that question.
Of course.
Is it a post-internet era that we're moving into?
I don't understand that term, because to me the internet has always been the connectivity of data and platforms. And so the fact that there's a new set of extraordinarily powerful data sources and platforms is just a validation that the internet people were right. And I'm proud to have been part of that, and I suspect many people I see in the room that I know feel the same way. We really created, as a group, something that will outlast all of us. And the impact of driving the information age, as you pointed out and as your folks in your video pointed out, is very, very real. So to me, if I look forward, I think about, I'll give you some examples. The real sort of interesting things that will happen in the next 5 or 10 years have to do with the integration of things that were not possible before. Let's think about holography. Because we have pictures of everything, you, of course, will build in your next house a memory room, which will synthetically recreate your memory in a holographic image that you'll just walk in so you can sort of feel it. It's obvious. The technology is available today. And of course, if you're well-to-do, people here in the Bay Area are pretty well-to-do, you'll probably have your own robot, which you'll send to the rock concert so that you can sit at home with your kids. But if you want to experience that pounding, you'll put your hands in the haptic gloves, put your headset on, and boy, you're going to be at that concert, right? And of course, the concert will charge a fee for your robot to attend, so everybody wins. You will take drugs that will help you be healthy. You'll take a pill, for example, that will Wi-Fi out your stomach situation. You think that I'm making that up? There is such a pill that was just approved by the FDA, right? Your grandmother or yourself had a fall. You needed a new hip. That titanium hip will Wi-Fi out. How's she doing? What's going on? How's mobility? What's going on with blood pressure? There'll be apps, how's my mom doing, right? People follow in certain patterns. She violates the pattern. Maybe she's in trouble. Maybe I should call her. I should call her anyway. But you get the idea. So the pervasive connectedness means that a new generation of devices, which have all been science fiction, will all be able to make our lives so much better, both in health and entertainment and education. We haven't talked about education much, but we're on the cusp of a revolution in education because of companies like Coursera, Udacity at the collegiate level, Khan Academy, I'm on their board, at the K-12 level, where we really can run the test of one learning paradigm versus another, and then with some real data, see if we can come up with the best way to educate the next generation of people, which is probably the most important thing all of us can do to serve society going forward.
I have such a stack of questions
here. Yes, looks like it.
And I'm going to ask a couple of them now. First of all, this is just fascinating to me. If return on investment was not your concern, what would you, let's say Google, what would you pursue that you aren't pursuing now because of that?
It's hard to know the answer to that question because as Larry and Sergey founded the company, and I certainly agreed, we thought it was important that Google be a for-profit company, that we thought that profits disciplined the management team, kept everybody focused. We also felt that ads had value. If I were to speculate, I would say that we would probably significantly increase our exploratory and early basic research into new areas that we could only imagine. If we had even more money, we could probably do that. As to whether we would tactically be able to do it, ultimately, companies at Google scale run out of people. We're ultimately constrained not by our vision, which of course is quite aggressive, or cash. In our case, we have, you know, on the order of too much, right? And we generate too much every quarter, right? It's ultimately about these unique leaders. And one of the great things about Silicon Valley is that we somehow produce these leaders that can somehow build these products, see the future, and run really fast. And I think that they're the real heroes of our valley.
Are you prepared for the inevitable self-driving car accident?
I am, and I'll take it as a very serious question. First place, there will be an accident. We haven't had any yet. Let me tell you why we're prepared for it. How many people died on American highways in 2012? Anybody know the number? It's about 30,000 people by the end of this year. On a miles-adjusted basis, that's a good number. If you are a family member or a friend who went through that, you know what a terrible tragedy that is. And it's not even covered these days. 30,000 of our fellow citizens being killed on the highways every day. So let's say that a combination of the technology that was invented at Google and other places could cut that number in half. I would love to have that happen. And yes, of course, there will be problems along the way. But to me, it's ultimately about lives. It's the most important thing you can do. Hmm.
Are you optimistic we're going to see self-driving cars become pervasive soon, or is this a longer-term project?
It will clearly be soon, but you have to define soon in car epochs. The car industry, for many reasons, is much slower than the computer industry in terms of innovation. It's reasonable to expect that some of the technology that Google has invented will see its way into cars that will be available to you over the next few years. As to whether, you know, they press the button, laugh, you know, drink a lot of beer while you're driving scenario, I think that's going to be a long time from now, probably not ever. It's important to know that these cars have a driver behind the wheel, and they have a really big red button right here. You go wham, so that you can stop in case something bad happens. And as long as we need that, you want to be careful. You want to be careful when you're driving anyway. To me, the real opportunity is, think about your teenager, right? You'd really want them to have a self-driving car, and you want to be able to program where it goes.
Or not go.
That's right.
There are some wonderful questions here for you as someone who's been through the ultimate startup and who also worked in a more traditional setting before you went to Google. So let me just see if I can pick one that summarizes what clearly young people in the audience are curious about. Could you give three, if there are three, most important lessons to us young programmers who aspire to be a CEO or a CTO of a big technology company?
I think that, well, there's a number of lessons. I think the first is that you won't be successful by being a general purpose person. In this market, which is so competitive, you have to be really good at something, and you have to build your credibility with that. I was fortunate that I was a programmer and an engineering manager and in these really narrow areas. And so I built my experience, but I started from a small but important and successful area. And I think all success ultimately starts from something small. And you look back and you remember that that was what you did just as hard as what you do now is. So that's sort of the first comment. I think the second comment is that most people, when they conceptualize what they're doing, understate the opportunity that technology provides. I've been guilty of this forever. One of the geniuses of Larry and Sergey was that they would always seek the impossible. Sometimes they were wrong, and I would argue with them. But overwhelmingly, their ambition in terms of the impact that they're going to have, they saw farther and faster.